Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live from 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock in the afternoon Pacific time, the regular time of our live broadcast. And if you're listening to the broadcast, you can be a participant by using your telephone and calling in with any questions that you might have about the Bible or about Christianity or about your own spiritual life. If you have heard the program before and you have some areas of disagreement with the host and would like to balance comment, please do. I'd be glad to hear from you today. The number is 1-800-438-5090. We actually have a line open right now if you'd like to call. It's 1-800-438-5090. Kevin from Mequon, Wisconsin is first today. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. I was calling in regard to yesterday's program. Gabriel had called in. I did believe he was your second last caller.
Yeah.
And he had referenced our conversation that you and I had on the air.
Right, and I had forgotten the details. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so the reason why I'm calling is because I'm sort of confused now because I think Gabriel thought you were saying something listening to that archive and got some clarifications, and your clarifications yesterday sort of were like, to me, I guess, were some of your statements opposed of some of those things that you said on December 1st, so I just wanted to call in and clarify, I guess.
Yeah, please do. Please remind me of what was it that I said then?
Well, you said then, and I'll maybe recap on the history of what the situation is briefly, but what you had said to me back then was basically to, your mom will need to feel that at Christmas time, and I had said to you, not being invited to our Christmas, and, you know, that this is her second Christmas for that it didn't really help last, or didn't seem to improve things last time. Secondly, I did say about I didn't want my mother around my children too much because of the bad influence, you know, that most grandmothers are obviously nice and sweet to their grandchildren, but yet, you know, my mom is really going against what God has for us in His Word, and she's okay with it, and I didn't want that example, in front of my children on a regular basis. So, those things, and one thing that you had said too when we went over 1 Corinthians 5 was, you had asked me, did you go over that with your mother, that you can't eat with her, and I said, yes, I have, and actually I gave her a podcast of someone else's program to listen to that I wanted to listen to with her and discuss with her afterwards, and she never got back to me, and she basically told my brother that she didn't want to meet with me because all I was going to do was preach to her. Some of the things that were said yesterday that Gabriel said and you said that, you know, we shouldn't be mean or spiteful or anything like that to my mother, and I'm not. It's certainly not being loving as God would have us to be to everyone. So my concern is now that I'm still doing the right thing. Will I talk to my mother on the phone? Sure. Will I invite her over to my house for this Christmas? The answer is no. I think 1 Corinthians applies there. 1 Corinthians 5 applies there. There was discussion also yesterday about, that was really meant for the church. Well, I guess I would say I am the church. You are the church. Gabriel is the church. And if we're not the church, who are we? I don't know, and real quick, to recap my family situation here, I grew up in a Baptist home. My mother, was probably one of the big reasons why, and, I guess planted the biggest seed with me to come to faith in Christ. She was huge in my upbringing that way. She had dabbled in this when I was a toddler. I found out my parents worked through that. she now went back to that and has gone to back to some relationship of her past when in high school after 40 some years of marriage, and went back to him and left the marriage, was living with this person who was also married to somebody else, and who was also married to somebody else, and she was also married to my dad while they were living together. And initially, like I said, I had hope. Where I found peace or hope was that I saw that she had a struggle. She admitted she was doing something wrong, and admitted it and said she couldn't help it and that she's struggling with it. And, you know, agrees with what I was saying, but yet doing it anyway. At least I saw a spirit-flesh struggle there. And at the end, and I would say even now, she would say she's not even sinning, where she, you know, broke the marriage without any biblical grounds. And the person she's with currently is still married to that other person. So I guess, again, my question would be, how much contact do I have to her biblically?
Yeah. Now, what I'm trying to figure out is what what you heard yesterday that you felt was different from what I said to you the first time. I believe that you are entirely justified in not having her with your family at Christmas time. You need to protect your children from influences that would confuse them. And your mother is clearly choosing a path of rebellion against God, although I presume still claiming to be a follower of Jesus. That can be a very confusing thing. And so I think protecting your children from that is fine. Now, yesterday, I think when Gabriel was talking, he mentioned that he thought 1 Corinthians chapter 5 was principally for the church. That is, that the church should not include such people in their services and even in their love feasts and so forth. And I told him that I thought that was true also. I thought that 1 Corinthians was primarily addressing the matter of the church. But I said also, you know, we're all members of the church, and so a person has to decide whether, you know, I think on a case-by-case basis, whether they are required to excommunicate a family member or not. I said that I think that even in cases where the church excommunicates, sometimes family members can still, you know, fellowship. But there certainly would be cases where fellowshipping with her would be damaging to your family, and in your case, it sounds like it would be, you know.
Right.
So, in my understanding, you are in a position to decide for the welfare of your own children in the matter. If you didn't have children, and your mother wanted to come over and eat with you without her adulterous partner,
right?
I don't think you would be in the wrong to eat with your mother. You would not be fellowshipping with her as a sister in the Lord. You would simply be having a family, you know, meal, and you know, secular family meal. So that'd be my thoughts. Yeah, I don't think that you're obligated to totally cut off all contact with your parent or your child or somebody who's in your household or whatever, just because they are under church discipline. I think that individuals still sometimes have obligations to honor their parents. But when the parents are doing things that would be damaging to your household for you to have them over, then I wouldn't recommend having them over. You got to kind of weigh the situation and
right.
See whose interests you're required to honor. And I think you have an obligation to your children at this point,
right,
more than to your mother.
Yeah, I guess what I'd heard you say yesterday was about, you know, I think the same was made that, if you're at a family function with her, you know, still talk with her and things like that. And I guess that sort of caught me off guard because, you know, our family function, I guess you wouldn't be there because of the situation. And, you know, all along she was, you know, spreading rumors, I guess, to other people that we know mutually, and she would say, you know, that we have cut her off. And, you know, I would talk to those people, and I would say, I think it's the other way around. When she walked away and walked away from the faith, she cut herself off.
That's right.
So I guess that's the route that I was taking on that. But
She made a decision. She made a decision to live in an illicit manner of life, which does not meet the conditions for you to fellowship with her or to expose your children to her. You know, I mean,
right. That
is her choice. She can't blame you for having standards. In fact, especially since she once had those standards herself and now she's just ignoring them. You know, she can't blame you for being consistent when she's decided to be inconsistent and betray what she believed.
Yeah. Okay, well, that clears up things for me here a little bit. I guess it doesn't have something to do with, I would think that the scripture is there for, maybe 1 Corinthians 5, that is, because, you know, also being public too in a church setting, if we, you know, fellowshiped and allowed those, people like my mother that were believers that walked away from the faith and are not living in unrepented sin, unrepentance about their sin, that, you know, if we have new people coming into our church that see people, hey, I know that person, they claim to be a believer, but yet are living in this, well, that must be accepted then, and that person would draw that conclusion. In the same respect, I think that's why it's there for us, not to break bread with a person like my mother, because if we were out in the public someplace, if a person knew what I believed and how I was in my faith, that if I was partaking in spending time with my mother, that I concurred with what she is doing and saying that that's okay.
Well, I mean, communication with your mother is not forbidden. Like Paul said, don't treat them as an enemy, but warn them, admonish them as a brother, it says. And therefore, I mean, you certainly don't have to give your mom a total shunning. But there certainly are situations that you would have to draw the line and say, you know, I don't mind communicating with you as long as you don't mind me, as you would say, preaching at you. Of course I'm going to preach at you. You preached at me when I was a child.
Right.
Because I needed to know the truth, and now the tables are turned. You need to know the truth, and I'm going to return the favor. You know,
right.
you did me good by preaching me about Jesus, and I'm going to have to do you good by preaching to you about Jesus, because you're falling away and you've forfeited your place in God's kingdom.
Right, and I've talked to her about that. If the tables were 100% or 180 degrees the other way, if I was doing this, I know for a fact you would be coming after me, and you should. So anyway, okay. Well, that clears up some things for me, Steve.
Okay. Good talking to you again, Kevin.
Hey, good talking to you. All right. Bye.
God bless you. Bye now. And that opens up a line for you. If you'd like to be on the program, the number is 1-800-438-5090. If you disagree with something you hear, feel free to call and say so. If you have a question of your own about the Bible or Christianity, call me on that. We can talk. The number 1-800-438-5090. Our next caller is Calvin, who's calling from St. Bonifacius. Is that right?
Yes.
Where is that?
It's over in Minnesota. It's about 35 minutes out of Minneapolis.
I see. Okay, so it's St. Bonifacius. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yes, St. Bonifacius.
Okay, great. Good to hear from you.
Yeah, thank you, Steve. My name's Calvin, as you said, and I was just calling with a question about the Olivet Discourse, and I've heard you teach on it before, and I guess my first question is I think over, I think it's over by verse 35.
You talking about Matthew's version, Matthew 24?
Yes, Matthew 24.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed, when you teach about it, like you're saying that, that there's like a break here, and then it goes like from verse 36 on, it goes on and talks about Christ's second coming. Is that correct?
That is my opinion, yes.
Okay, and I was wondering, like, could you just elaborate a little more on how you can see a break there, like from what it's talking about beforehand and afterwards?
Yeah. Well, first of all, Matthew combines material from two different discourses here in Matthew 24. Okay. Jesus gave a discourse on the Mount of Olives, and that's why it's called the Olivet Discourse, to four of his disciples when they had left the temple and Jesus had made a prediction that the temple would be destroyed and not one stone would be left standing on another. These four disciples came to him on the Mount of Olives and they asked him, when will that be and what sign will there be that that's about to happen? Now, we read that much in Matthew 24 and Luke 21 and Mark 13. Okay, and so Jesus gives them an answer to that question, which obviously is primarily about when will the temple in Jerusalem be destroyed and what sign will there be that is about to happen. Now, on the other hand, after a certain point in Matthew 24, we begin to see Jesus talking about things that, well, might not be about that. It sounds like it could be about the end of the world or the judgment or whatever. And so some people get confused and they say, well, the whole chapter is about the second coming of Christ and the end of the world. Others say, no, the whole chapter is about what happened to Jerusalem in AD 70. But in my opinion, part of the chapter is about AD 70 and part of it is not. But I don't believe that the whole discourse, as we find it in Matthew chapters 24 and 25, I don't think that whole discourse was necessarily given on one occasion. Now, I could be wrong, but I think I'm right, because we have in Luke's version of the same material, in Luke 21, we have the part about the destruction of Jerusalem. But we also have in another place in Luke 17, beginning at verse 20, we have another discourse on a different occasion. And that discourse that Luke records on a different occasion in Luke 17 has some of the material in it that we find added to Matthew 24. That is to say, it looks like Matthew 24, the first part of it, parallels the Olivet Discourse in Luke 21. But after a certain point, it appears to parallel a different discourse in Luke 17. Which means that it would appear that Matthew has taken two different discourses that are on similar sounding subjects and has put them together in one chapter. Now, I'll tell you why I think the break comes at that point in just a moment, but I want to say that if that seems like a strange thing for Matthew to do, it isn't strange at all. Matthew's gospel places almost the entire teaching of Jesus in five segments, five discourses, as we would say. And these discourses are all expanded discourses. That is to say, we find some of the same discourses elsewhere in the other Gospels, but much shorter. Mm-hmm. For example, the Sermon on the Mount. In Matthew, it's three chapters long. In Matthew 5, 6, and 7, we have the Sermon on the Mount. In Luke, that sermon is only one half of one chapter long, in Luke 6. Mm-hmm. Now, so we see that that Matthew has included the Sermon on the Mount from Luke 6, but he also has other material that he's included in it, which Luke records in other settings. In other words, what Matthew has done has given a topical arrangement of the teaching of Jesus. He uses perhaps an actual discourse as the framework, and then he supplies other things that Jesus said on the same subjects in other places, and he puts them in there too, so he's got this kind of conflated discourse. And this is true of all five of Matthew's discourses. The first one is the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5, 6, and 7. The second one, I would call it the missionary discourse he gives in Matthew chapter 10. And then there's the parables discourse in Matthew 13. And then there's a relationship discourse in Matthew 18. And then there's the Olivet discourse in Matthew 24 and 25. Now, all of these discourses in Matthew have some parallels in the other Gospels. But what we find in the other Gospels is that they are shorter in the other Gospels and that Matthew has gathered material into his presentation that is found scattered throughout the other Gospels. And that is, Jesus gave these teachings on various occasions, but Matthew has put it together in a topical arrangement in these collections. Now, that's also true, apparently, of Matthew chapter 24 and 25. And as we can see, part of Matthew 24 appears to be the same discourse that's recorded in Luke 21. But part of Matthew 24 seems to be part of the same discourse that is in a different place in Luke, in Luke 17. I take the division point between the two at Matthew 24, verses 35 and 36. Now, my argument is this, that Jesus has been asked about the destruction of Jerusalem. He answers the question of the disciples, and he gives an answer to both questions. One question is, when will these things be? The other is, what sign will there be that these things are about to take place? Well, in answer to the first question, when will these things be? In verse 34, he says, truly I tell you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. So they want to know when these things will be. He says, it's going to happen in this generation. Now, to their question, what sign will there be that it's about to take place? He answers that in verse 15. He says, so when you see the desolating sacrifice, the abomination of desolation, standing in the holy place, as was spoken by the prophet Daniel, then you need to flee from Judea, he said. So he answers both their questions of timing and of what sign will be given. But after he says that, after verse 34, when he says, truly I tell you, this generation will not pass away until all these things have taken place, that seems to be summarizing all the things he said before that verse. But then, in verse 35, he says, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. Now, there, he has made a different prediction. He said, heaven and earth is going to pass away. Well, that didn't happen in AD 70. That hasn't even happened yet. Heaven and earth still exist. And therefore, I believe he has changed subjects, and he now moves to the subject of the other discourse that's in Luke 17, which is, I believe, the second coming of Christ. And when he has introduced the idea of the heavens and the earth passing away, he says in Matthew 24:36, but about that day and hour no one knows, neither the angels of heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. And so what he has said is, with reference to the destruction of Jerusalem, he gave them a clue. It's going to happen in this generation. But when it comes to the destruction of the heavens and the earth, no one knows when that's going to be, he said. Only the Father knows that. So I believe he has two different subjects that he's addressing. And just like I believe that Luke was addressing two different subjects, or that is, Jesus was in Luke's gospel, in Luke 17 and Luke 21. But Matthew has combined the two or put them into one chapter.
So you said over in Luke there's more of a clear distinction there between those subjects?
Well, some don't think so. In my opinion, there is, but some think not. There's differences of opinion about it. I believe that in Luke 21, it is more clearly a question and answer about the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. In Luke 17, beginning with verse 20, it appears to be talking about something beyond that, which I take to be the second coming of Christ.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, that's definitely an interesting take, and I'm considering it more. I originally for my home church, you know, was taught kind of a dispensational interpretation, but
yeah.
But I've been hearing the case you've been making too, and so I'm just kind of considering that too, and just kind of trying to wrestle with it all and trying to make sense
of
it.
Yeah. Well, good luck.
Yeah, thank you. Well, thank you very much for your answer. I appreciate it.
All right. God bless you. Thanks for your call, Calvin.
You too. Bye.
Bye now. All right. Our next caller is Grant, calling from Sweet Home, Oregon. Grant, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm interested in getting your thoughts on a situation that probably many people have at Christmas time, and that is, our kids know there's no Santa Claus.
Yeah.
And we're taking them to somebody's house who is going to be celebrating Santa Claus.
Uh-huh.
I'm curious to know how you would handle that and get your thoughts on that, and I'll take your question off or answer off the air.
Okay, Grant, thanks for your call. Well, okay, you have taught your kids not to believe in Santa Claus. You're going to celebrate Christmas with people whose children do believe in Santa Claus. I'm assuming the adults don't. So it's going to be just the children. And therefore, I think you should probably instruct your children not to talk to their children about Santa Claus. Now, my parents raised me not believing in Santa Claus. My parents never did lie to us about that. And therefore, we never did believe in Santa Claus. But some of the neighborhood parents got angry at my parents because when I was a kid, a little kid, I told my friends that there's no Santa Claus and that my parents had told me so. And, of course, their kids then came back to them and said, hey, you know, the Greggs say there's no Santa Claus. So it kind of rained on their parade, you know. And so I would suggest you don't rain on their parade. I don't think it's right to tell your children there's a Santa Claus because I don't think it's right to lie. And there isn't a Santa Claus. I also think it could have negative ramifications on their on the credibility of the parents when they talk about God to the children. Because Santa Claus, as he is described in the fiction, is a lot like God. He knows you. He knows when you're asleep. He knows when you're awake. He knows you've been bad or good. He's going to reward you when you do good. You never see him, but he's really there looking. I mean, isn't that kind of like God? And so if you tell your children there's a Santa Claus and later say, we were just kidding, and then you've told your kids there's a God, maybe the kids think, well, maybe they were just kidding then, too. If Jesus said, he that is faithful in that which is least will be faithful in that which is greatest. If you're honest in one matter, then you can be expected to be honest generally. But if you prove to be dishonest in one matter, then you raise questions about your honesty about other matters. And so I would, I don't know how old your children are, but I would tell them, that although there is no Santa Claus, that some parents want their children to believe there is, and that it'd be best if they did not inform the other children about that. That's not really your children's task to set those children straight. It may be that the other parents are making a mistake, but it's theirs to make. It's not your children's place to correct. In a sense, they're overriding the decision of the parents. Now, if it was necessary, for example, for your kids to evangelize these kids and their parents didn't want them to be evangelized, I would say you'd have a duty. Nonetheless, if your children wanted to evangelize them, go ahead, because the mandate to evangelize, I believe, stands above the rights of parents to keep their children in ignorance. But telling the truth about Santa Claus isn't on the same level as evangelism, and I don't think it's a necessary topic for them to discuss. Now, if your children are real little and you're not sure whether they're really able to keep it to themselves, for example, if the other kids say, hey, well, Santa Claus is going to bring me such and such, and you've got a three-year-old who isn't, doesn't have a lot of self-control in their speech, and oh, no, there's no Santa Claus, that is a possibility. And what I would do before you even go to your friends is tell them, you know, our children don't believe in Santa Claus. And I don't know whether that would come up in a conversation between my children and your children. If that would bother you, I've told my children not to bring it up, but if they would, and if that would bother you, I just want you to be forewarned. It could. If you'd prefer we didn't come over, then we'll honor that. In others, I think you should just honor the other parents' right to be the parents of their own children, even if they're making a mistake. It'd be a good thing to inform them that you have taken a different position and that your children may, because of your influence on them in this area, your children might say something that they don't want their children to hear. And then let them decide what to do about it. If they say, well, we'll take that chance when it comes, or if they say, no, this we don't want to take that chance, they just have to make their own decision about that, and you should honor that. That's what I would say. My kids, by the way, grew up not believing in Santa Claus either, but I don't know if they had friends who did, because almost all of our friends were homeschooling Christian families, and I don't think any of them believed in Santa Claus. Let's talk to Laura from Lake Stevens, Washington next. Hi, Laura. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. You'll have to excuse me. I've got laryngitis today.
Okay. My throat's a little sore, too.
Oh, yeah. I think I'm doing my Marlo Thomas impersonation. I guess I just would love to hear your speculation on what the strong delusion or great lie could be. I mean, I have my thoughts, you know, of what that would possibly be. I mean, I think it probably will have to do with Christ and whether he was really resurrected. I mean, resurrected. I think that would be what Satan would try to bring in. But just wondering what your ideas are on that.
Okay. Okay, and were you hoping to just listen on the radio rather than stay on the phone, since you got laryngitis? You can stay on if you want.
Okay, I think I'll stay on.
Okay, fine. Well, the question of the big lie or the strong delusion is a reference to what Paul said in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 in connection with the coming of the lawless one, the man of sin, the son of perdition. Paul said that there is a coming lawless one who will, you know, set himself above God and will say he's God. And it says in verse 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, it says in verse 8, then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord Jesus will destroy with the breath of his mouth, destroying him by the manifestation of his coming. He said the coming of the lawless one is apparent in the working of Satan, who uses all power, signs, and lying wonders and every kind of wicked deception for those who are perishing because they refuse the love of the truth to be saved. Now, this is the verse that matters. For this reason, God sends them a powerful delusion, leading them to believe what is false. Okay? And he says, so that all will perish who did not believe the truth but took pleasure in unrighteousness. Now, as I understand it, the man of sin, I actually have a different view about the man of sin than probably the most popular view today. Today, the view is that the man of sin, this is the dispensational view, that the man of sin is an individual who is going to come in the last days and is going to be like a world dictator and is going to deceive the world and be a false Christ and so forth. And that he is the one that they call the Antichrist. Although he's not called the Antichrist here, but popularly, he is identified with the one they call Antichrist. Now, I don't see it that way. I used to, but I see it differently now. The way I see it is the way that it was pretty much understood by most of the leaders of the early Protestant church. The idea that the man of sin is a future individual actually didn't come into the Protestant churches until about the 19th century. But before that, the Protestants believed that the man of sin that Paul talked about was actually a reference to the institution of the papacy. Martin Luther believed this. John Calvin believed this. John Knox believed this. John Wycliffe believed this. John Huss believed this. William Tyndale believed this. All the early Reformation and pre-Reformation guys who were frankly anti-Catholic, they believed that Paul was predicting the rise of the papacy and that the things that Paul said the man of sin would do actually has been done by one or another of the popes over history. And therefore, they don't see the man of sin as somebody who's just going to show up for a little while as an individual in the end of the world, but they see him more as a composite of the whole institution of papal Roman Catholicism. Now, obviously, that's an anti-Catholic position. And these days, we Protestants aren't quite so hard on the Catholics, and the Catholics aren't quite so hard on us anymore either, as they used to be. But even though we may not have any malice against Roman Catholics, we need to consider whether the interpretation has merit. And in my opinion, there is some merit in the interpretation. It was something that arose after Paul's time, so he would predict it as a future thing. But he said it would happen when there was a great falling away. He said that, of course, in verse 3, let no one deceive you. In any way, the Lord's coming will not come unless the falling away comes first and the lawless one is revealed. So he indicates that the rise of the lawless one would follow a great falling away. And then, of course, because people would follow the lawless one and reject the truth, God would send them strong delusion so that they believe the lie. What I understand this to be saying is that the church eventually fell away from its pure doctrine and its pure practice that existed in the days of the apostles and during the time of the Christian martyrs in the second and third century. Eventually, the church degenerated into a more political kind of an entity, especially after Constantine was converted because he was the political leader of Rome. He was the emperor. And so eventually the church was wedded with the state and became more loyal to a political state than to Christ. And that I consider to be probably what Paul means by the falling away. As a result of that, there arose a political power in the church. which was, of course, the Pope. And eventually the popes ruled over Europe, even over the kings of Europe. Even the emperors had to submit to the Pope. And so many of the popes did claim to be God. Many of them did the kinds of things that Paul talks about here. And so it would appear that such a thing did occur after Paul predicted it. And I don't know if the Reformers were right about it, but I think that their arguments are reasonably sound. And so I'm undecided, but I tend to side with them to a certain degree. And therefore, the strong delusion that God sends to people is really, as it says, so they'll believe the lie, that there is a false Christianity that arose in place of the true Christianity. And true Christians then became sort of a dissenting remnant. Of course, the Roman Catholic Church started the Inquisitions and such to kill off and torture those who were the dissenting remnant. But anyway, there were dissenters throughout all of church history, and eventually some of them succeeded in starting a movement called the Reformation. But people had the choice to follow the truth that Jesus taught or to succumb to the lie. And Paul is saying that those that actually succumb to the lie are those who actually loved not the truth, but they had pleasure in wickedness, and therefore God gave them over to follow their lusts and to follow the lie. That is what pretty much the classic Protestant view has been until very recent times. And then I've looked at it, and I've looked at the arguments for the modern view, and I think the older view probably makes more sense biblically to me.
Okay, well, thank you.
All right, Laura. God bless you. Good talking to you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye now. All right, that makes a line open for you. You're listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg, and if you'd like to call, you can reach me at 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. We're getting a call next from Joe from Scottsdale, Arizona. Joe used to call us from Henderson, Nevada. Hi, Joe. Good to hear from you.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
Good. Good to hear from you.
Thanks. Good to hear you. Steve, I have a pre-question to my question, if I can just tag along on that last caller there.
Okay.
Is there a possibility, or does anybody hold the view that the lawless one might have been Caesar or Nero? And the reason I say that is in Matthew 24, it says also in verse 10 that there's going to be a great falling away, and there's going to be many false messiahs and many false teachers in those days. And then it talks about the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet. I kind of always thought, for some reason, in the back of my head, that might have alluded to Caesar or Titus. And is there anybody that's held that position, or is it just kind of unique flowing with it?
Well, with reference to the abomination of desolation, there's good reason to apply it to Titus. Of course, Nero was dead by then. Nero killed himself in 68 A.D., and then it was 2 years later that... when Nero killed himself, Vespasian was leading the Roman armies in the war against the Jews, and then Vespasian was elected to be emperor, and he returned to Rome. And then he sent his son Titus at the head of the Roman armies to besiege Jerusalem and to destroy it. So Titus, came along after Nero's death to power. Eventually, after Vespasian, Titus became emperor too. But I don't know that any of them have ever been called the man of sin, but they may have. There certainly have been many who thought that the beast in Revelation was Nero, or the emperor, maybe the emperor Domitian. So there have been different opinions about that. I'm not sure that I've read anyone that said that the man of sin or the son of perdition was necessarily the emperor, but there certainly probably have been people who've taken that position, because some of the emperors did claim themselves to be God. And I don't know that, the reference to the false Christs and the false messiahs and so forth would be the same as the falling away here. Because there were false Christs and false messiahs for a long time that did not necessarily result in the church falling away. Jesus warned against them. And hopefully most of the church did ignore them. They were there. But I think that the church didn't fall away into something pagan and unchristian until a few centuries later. So I usually wouldn't see it as Nero or Titus.
Okay. Okay. And I want to tag along on another question that another one of your callers had there. When they asked about the break in the Olivet Discourse that you say probably occurred around Matthew 24, 35, and 36.
Yeah.
It's ironic. It seems to me that Mark does the same exact thing.
Uh-huh.
So wouldn't it be kind of odd that both of them would write it topically like that and both of them would break? Because the way you were answering the question, it seemed like it was a unique condition that Matthew did only in writing this.
Well, I didn't say it was unique to Matthew. I said Matthew did this, so I'm not saying
right.
No one else did that. You know,
right.
most scholars feel that Matthew had Mark's gospel in front of him and used Mark as one of his sources. So if Mark had done this first, Matthew might have followed his lead. But I'm not really sure that I could say for sure. We do have, you're right, in Mark 13:32, we have Mark also recording, of that day and hour no one knows, not the angels of heaven, but the Father. But
right.
After that, nothing in Mark's gospel parallels Matthew 24, really, except to
right.
keep awake, except to keep
right.
awake, yeah.
Right, okay. One more
anyway,
quick one?
Yeah, there's a lot of opinions about that. Go ahead.
Okay, a real quick one here. Mark, in Mark 8:33, Jesus called Peter Satan, and this seems to be subsequent to him sending out the apostles two by two, and so I'm assuming, and they cast out demons and they healed the sick and so on. So I'm assuming that Peter had to have been full of the Spirit. Now, when he was calling Peter Satan, was he literally addressing Peter in a derogatory way? Was he literally talking to Satan, who had all of a sudden possessed Peter after being filled with the Spirit? Or what exactly is going on there?
Well, I don't think that Jesus is suggesting that Peter was possessed by Satan. And I would also say I don't believe that Peter was filled with the Spirit at this point. The Bible indicates that at the day of Pentecost, they were all filled with the Spirit. Prior to that, it's true that Jesus gave them power and gave them authority to cast out demons and to heal sickness on some short-term outreaches. But this doesn't seem to be something that resided in them at all times while Jesus was present. It's like he sent out the 12 once in Matthew chapter 10, and he sent out the 70, which probably included the 12 and others, in Luke chapter 10. But in those occasions, he gave them authority to cast out demons and to heal the sick and raise the dead and so forth. But we don't know that he actually filled them with the Spirit. They were more spokesmen of his authority. He could do that by his authority, and they could do it as he authorized them. But their being filled with the Spirit doesn't seem to be something that was that happened before Pentecost. In fact, it specifically says in John chapter 7 and verse 39 that the Spirit was not yet given while Jesus was not yet glorified. That is, before the resurrection of Christ, the Spirit was not yet given to the disciples. So the ability to cast out demons and so forth that was given to them earlier was not the same thing as the filling of the Spirit. But getting back to the reference to Peter as Satan, Peter had spoken words where Peter thought he was being sympathetic toward Jesus, but Jesus recognized in what Peter said the voice of Satan. Now, the idea that Satan may have spoken through Peter doesn't necessarily, translate into Peter being demon-possessed. I believe I've heard Satan speak through many people, including Christians, who are not necessarily demon-possessed people. But rather, he is the father of all lies, Jesus said in John 8:44, that Satan is the father of all lies. And therefore, the deception and the misdirection that was coming out of Peter's mouth toward Jesus at that point, Jesus recognized that although Peter was expressing his own opinion, that opinion was, as it were, inspired by, not by God, but by Satan.
It was satanic. In essence?
Right. It was satanic, right. And it's interesting, Jesus then said to him, your thoughts, he says, you're not savoring the things of God. You're savoring the things of man. He didn't even say you're savoring the things of Satan. He said, you're saving the things of man, that man thinks one way and God thinks another way. Peter was thinking the way men think, not the way God does. But because he was thinking that, he was susceptible to having thoughts occur to him, and even for him to think them good, which were really planted there by the devil. I mean,
so
this is a really
emphasizing the point. Then it was an emphatic pronouncement when he called him Satan, but he wasn't literally Satan. It was just the emphasis that
I think
I think
that Jesus recognized in Peter's appeal, he recognized the voice of Satan. Not speaking, as it were, like a demon speaks through the vocal cords of a demon-possessed person, but rather, you know, Satan channels his philosophy into the world through human brains. I mean, people who succumb to error and to sin and to false philosophies, they're not necessarily demon-possessed, but the devil is the author of the lies that they're believing. They get channeled through false teachers who are not necessarily demon-possessed. I mean, college professors and movie makers and talk show hosts and so forth, none of whom might be demon-possessed. But if their thoughts are wrong, then they are thoughts that have come to them by the suggestion of the devil. And for us to be able to discern that, you know, somebody speaking to us, although it's a trusted friend, as in this case, Peter was a trusted friend of Jesus, it may be that trusted friends of ours will speak, and it'll really be the devil's message coming through. And Jesus commented on it and actually spoke, I think, to Satan, saying, "Katcha, Satan, I hear you talking there through Peter." You know, Job didn't say the same thing, but he could have, because the devil had predicted that he could get Job to curse God and die. And when Job was in his trials, his wife came to him and said, "Why don't you just curse God and die?" You know, the very thing that the devil was trying to persuade Job to do, his wife suggested. Now, Job could rightly have said, "I hear the devil" in that remark, although Job probably didn't know the devil existed. He didn't have a Bible. But the point is that this was a trusted family member, or in the case of Jesus and Peter, a trusted friend, someone that you'd normally have your guard, you wouldn't have your guard up. You'd expect them to say sympathetic things. And in both cases, it's possible that Job's wife was sympathetic with Job and said, "You've suffered enough. Why don't you just give it up and die and be out of your misery?" And, you know, Peter said something that was obviously intended out of sympathy for Jesus. But it sort of illustrates what the book of Proverbs tells us in two different places. The same proverb is found twice in the book of Proverbs. It says, "There's a way that seems right to a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death." That is, there's times when our sentiments would tell us that something is right, but it isn't right. And when Peter spoke up on this occasion, Jesus had been predicting his own death. Now, certainly to a friend of Jesus would say, "Well, wait a minute, I don't want you to die. You know, if you get in trouble, you come to me, I'll help you. You know, I'm not going to let them kill you." Now, all of that certainly seemed right to Peter, but he wasn't taking into consideration God's agenda here. God's agenda was that Jesus die, but he didn't know that. And so he was speaking well-intentioned and sympathetic words. He was doing what seemed right to him, but it wasn't the right way. And Jesus had to correct him and say, "No, your thoughts are not God's thoughts." But when he said, "Get behind me, Satan," I wouldn't be surprised if Jesus was kind of speaking past Peter, recognizing that Satan is behind that suggestion, not so much that Peter is Satan.
Right. That I would imagine Peter must have been quite shocked, and he must have realized whether it was, I guess it wasn't Satan speaking through him, but whether his careless words, not thinking before saying something, it must have really shocked him to have Jesus say that to him.
I would imagine that's so. Yeah.
Right. Very interesting. Thank you, Steve. I appreciate it.
It's great to hear from you, Joe. It's been a long time.
God bless you. Bye-bye.
Keep in touch. God bless you. Bye now. All right. We're going to talk next to John from Bellevue, Washington. John, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. Just a quick question. As much as, like, the Santa Claus that you said atomic blood is a lie.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be a lie to tell my kids that Jesus was born on December 25th?
Yes, that would be a lie too.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how would I convey them without, like, offending other
people? I'll tell you what I would say to that if I was giving, again, instructions to my children. I would never say Jesus was born on December 25th, but I would say that on December 25th, the world has celebrated the birth of Jesus. Now, that doesn't mean that his birthday was actually December 25th, but that is the customary time that people celebrate the birth of Jesus. Just like sometimes when people die, you have the memorial service weeks later. You know, it doesn't have to, that you have a memorial service for someone who died doesn't mean that you're having it the same day that they died. It doesn't have to be the same day. You can celebrate their life at a later time. And likewise, if somebody wants to celebrate the birth of Jesus, and by the way, as far as we know, the disciples never did. We don't have any record of the disciples ever celebrating Christmas on any day of the year. But if somebody wants to celebrate the birth of Jesus, they could pretty much pick any day they want to do it. And since December 25th is the day that traditionally has come to be associated with that, I would tell my children that's the day that people often celebrate the birth of Jesus. So about Santa Claus, I wouldn't have any problem saying, you know, even though there's no Santa Claus, there's a lot of people who like to imagine this guy who comes around and brings gifts to kids. It's not true, but, you know, it's kind of I guess they find it to be fun. And, you know, if my kids wanted to participate in the fantasy, I wouldn't encourage it, but I wouldn't, you know, if they knew it was a fantasy, well, we'd like to pretend there's a guy like that, too. Well, okay, let them. You know, as long as they're not deceived about it, as long as they know it's pretend.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, John, God bless you.
Yeah. You too, bye-bye.
All right, you've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. We're just about out of time. In about 10 seconds, I'm going to be hearing the theme music. I'm anticipating it, so I'm going to wind it down here. If you've never heard the program before, we are a daily broadcast, weekdays from 2 to 3 in the afternoon, Pacific time. And it's live whenever it can be. It's almost always live. And so I come to this microphone for an hour a day and take your phone calls. If you have questions or even if you have disagreements, be happy to talk to you about those things. It's an open forum. There is no church or denomination behind this program, so we don't actually have anyone forcing us to say the party line about anything. My attempt is to give an honest answer from the Bible as best as I understand it. Although I don't claim to know all the answers I give are the ones that I believe to be found in the Bible, and they often do not reflect perhaps the most popular views out there today. Some people may not like that, and that's okay. No one's obligated to like the program, but some people do. And those of you who do should know that we bring the program to you every day by paying for radio time. Thousands, tens of thousands of dollars per month. And that money, you notice we don't have any commercial breaks because we don't sell anything. Neither here nor at our website, we don't sell anything. We don't have any major underwriters, but we are listener supported. If you'd like to help us stay on the air where you're listening, you can write to the Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. You can find that address and many free resources at our website, thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com. My name's Steve Gregg. Thanks for joining us. I hope you'll tune in again tomorrow so we can continue our discussion.